You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. Really pleased to have with me for the first time, Peter Buchvar. He is the Chief Investment Officer of Bleakley Advisory Group, $3.5 billion wealth management firm located in New Jersey, and he is the editor of the Book Report. He previously was the Chief Market Analyst for the Lindsay Group, that's a macroeconomic and market research firm, started by Larry Lindsay, who was a director of the National Economic Council and assistant to the president on economic policy for the President George W. Bush. Peter's market insights are frequently sought out by industry leaders, and for several years he has been a regular guest host and contributor on CNBC. He is also regularly quoted in articles in Forbes, Barron's, Bloomberg, CNN Money, and a number of other outlets. So Peter has graduated with distinguished honors from George Washington University. Certainly somebody that I have been watching and observing for some time, mostly at CNBC in the past. But it's really great to have him with us, a person of this background. Very blessed to have Peter with us today. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
Thanks, Jay. I appreciate having me on.
It's really good to have you. You know, this is your first time on the show, so I thought I might ask you perhaps talk a little bit about Bleakley Advisory Group. What can you tell us about this group, and then maybe talk a little bit about how you're managing the portfolio in this environment, like it, just in general, what sort of things you're owning?
Right. So Bleakley is a wealth management firm with about 50 different advisors, most of them in New Jersey, but in many other cities. We're actually probably up to about $8 billion now amongst the different advisors.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
I run the investment committee, so I help put together client portfolios in addition to running two of my own strategies, one being a global macro and another one being an income-focused strategy. I think that the word diversification is the typical cliche that people throw out there in terms of a portfolio for the average client. But right now, I think it's pretty important to actually have one. You know, we're in a world where there is nothing cheap anymore. Or I shouldn't say nothing. There's fewer and fewer things that are cheap out there. A lot of things are expensive in the equity world, but particularly U.S. markets, certainly in credit, fixed income, you have what I believe is been an epic bubble, but a bubble that's been going on for years, and negative interest rates is sort of the epitome of that when you've turned an asset into a liability. So trying to create a portfolio that can grow with that client's financial needs is getting more and more difficult relative to the risk that you are taking to try to get that incremental return. So being a value investor, I feel like my options are becoming more limited, but I'm still finding them, mostly out in areas outside the U.S. I think mm-hmm. that when you look at over the last 10 years, the U.S. market has so outperformed the rest of the world, where the sort of the market cap of the U.S. market relative to U.S. GDP has become very outsized relative to international markets relative to their level of GDP. So when looking for value, I think people need to widen their geographic focus. Now, mm-hmm. part of the reason for the U.S. overvaluation is, yes, it's monetary policy, low rates, but it's also the incredible performance of U.S. technology companies that, uh-huh. Outside of a few names in China, is very much unmatched around the world. And that is also a reason why our markets are very expensive. But, you know, as we've seen with earnings season, where good earnings were not rewarded, it's a sign that we've priced in a lot of good news, that valuations have probably gotten way too stretched, and it's time to digest some of the recent gains.
Mm-hmm. I'm guessing of the two strategies you you manage on your own, you said income and global macro, that global macro would be a lot, you'd have more opportunities there than on the income side. I'm just wondering, where in the world do you go to get income these days that's safe?
Well, income, I mean, there's still, you look at Europe, there's still some good, decent paying, dividend paying companies in Europe. There's some the same in Asia. There aren't so many, but I find dividend yields more attractive outside the U.S. I mean, you take, for example, the FTSE 100 in the U.K. So you have the dividend yield of the S&P 500, which is about 1.5 to 1.6%. The dividend yield in the U.K. is 3.5%. If you go over to Asia, and the dividend yield of the Singapore stock market, to use that as a market there, the dividend yield is 3.3%. So there's yield to be had, but you have to widen your eyes outside the U.S. Now, there's still some good dividend-paying stocks in the U.S. That'll give you 3%, 4%, 5%. So I don't want to downplay the opportunities that are here for those that are looking for income. But it's more slimmer pickings in the U.S. relative to other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. So would you say the balance of your portfolio, the income portfolio, is overseas? I guess it probably is.
No, it's a combination because, you know, I'm still finding income opportunities in the U.S. You know, with real estate, you know, REITs included in that. Interestingly, with the U.S. REIT market, is yes, they're sensitive to interest rates. They'll be sensitive to Fed policy, but there's a pretty wide gap between the private real estate markets, which are trading extraordinarily rich with cap rates down to 3.5%, and public REITs that high quality ones that are that have cap rates that are above the private market.
We've titled today's show, Is Inflation Transitory? I guess that's a big question in everybody's minds. The Fed wants us to believe it is. You know, there's a certain amount of anticipation. The Fed has to try to get us to think the way they want us to think, for sure, so we'll behave in the way they want us to behave. Do you have a forecast? I'm sure you do have a forecast for inflation. And interest rates. Well, starting out with inflation, do you think it's transitory, as Jay Powell tells us it is?
Well, first, before I answer that question, the interesting thing about the Fed is that while they're saying it's transitory, because that's what they believe, on the other hand, they don't want it to be transitory because their policy has been codified to say we believe in asymmetric inflation policy. So they want a period of time of non-transitory inflation to, I believe, nonsensically offset a period of below target inflation. I think this is all gobbledygook, crackpot economics, but it is the policy that they have. So they, on one hand, say it's not transitory because they don't want the market to jump the gun in terms of thinking that the Fed is getting closer to tapering, let alone raise interest rates at some point. But on the other hand, as I said, they don't want it to be transitory because it meets their nonsense inflation goal. I happen to believe that it is not transitory. And to break down inflation, which I like to do, is you have the services side of the economy, which services inflation ex energy is about 60% of the CPI. So just use the CPI, regardless of what you think about CPI or not. It is 60% of it. And services inflation for the last 30 years has averaged about 3%. Even over the last 10 to 20 years here, it's averaged 2.5 to 2.7%. That is pretty persistent inflation. It's due to higher rents, medical care, insurance, tuition. Even every year you go to the movie theater, it costs, you know, a dollar more at the movie theater. Pre-COVID, of course, we were seeing continuous rising prices for airline tickets and hotels and so on. It was always the good side of the economy that saw price compression. Sensibly so because of technology and production efficiency, just naturally is a depressant on price increases. All you have to do is look at the whole technology sector over the past 30 years. But now we are, so we saw with COVID a slowdown in the rate of services growth because rents fell sharply in the big cities and the pace of growth in other cities slowed. And obviously people weren't going out, so other parts of the service economy saw price declines. And you saw this big rise in goods inflation. Now you're seeing a resumption higher in services inflation. So the whole transitory debate now comes down to what do goods prices do from here? And I'm of the belief that the sharp rise in commodity prices is not going to recede anytime soon, that while supply chains may get sort of smoothed out somewhat over the next couple of quarters, there's still going to be issues and prices are still going to remain elevated. And the cost of transportation, which is a key part of the discussion about goods inflation, because every single thing that is produced in this world ends up on either a plane, a ship, a railroad, or a truck. In 2019, we saw a huge amount of truck bankruptcies in response to the tariff battle with China. We've seen massive consolidation in the shipper container business over the last bunch of years. So I don't think that the rise in transportation cost is so temporary. So I'm of the belief that inflation is going to be stickier than the Fed thinks. And I think come summertime, people are going to start to realize that by seeing 3 to 4 tenths month over month increases in CPI and PCE and realize this is not going to recede so quickly. That will then be the potential blueprint for another leg higher in longer-term interest rates, and then will intensify the pressure on the Fed to taper their QE policy.
Well, higher rates, what is that going to do to the equity market?
Well, we've seen a rise in the 10-year this year from 90 basis points at the end of 2020 to about 160 today, so 70 basis points. That's almost three rate hikes, essentially, and the market's powered through it because the market said, well, it's happening for a good reason. The economy is rebounding, and, yeah, inflation's here, but we'll celebrate the improving economy. That said, there has been a valuation rethink on a bunch of different parts of the tech market that worked so well on the work-from-home trade last year, like Zoom, for example, to use that as an example, or Teladoc, that had incredible 2020s, but valuations that got way too expensive, and the same can be said for other software names. So I think there has been a response in the frothy parts of the market. SPACs have cooled down as well. That I think is also in response to the rise in rates, and also just, you know, too much froth got into that part of the market. So I think we've already seen a response, and but it hasn't hit the broader market. I think if you get 2% plus in the 10-year, which I do think we'll see, then it has, you know, a broader potential reverberations.
2% might be the breaking point. And then what does a 2% rate do to the federal budget, given Mr. Biden's expenditures?
Right. Well, some of it has to do with where short rates will go, because you know, the Treasury has been issuing a lot of shorter term paper. That's why our average maturity is only about 6 years. So the Fed will try to anchor that. Now, 2% doesn't sound like a lot in the 10-year, but we have to remember that in the fourth quarter of 2018, all it took was a 2.5% Fed funds rate to cause a major hissy fit in the markets. So it's really not the absolute level. It's the rate of change. And when you have as much debt as we have, all it takes is modest changes in interest rates times a very large amount of debt equals a lot of dollars.
It just seems it's hard for me to understand who's going to buy U.S. Treasuries. I guess, well, you probably own some in your income fund because you
well,
need
you
the liquidity.
Well, you will. It's just a matter of what yield you'll demand.
Yeah. But, I mean, I remember I lived very much through the stagflation of the 70s. Do you see any possibility of that sort of scenario evolving again?
I definitely see a stagflationary type of environment, not to the extent in terms of the absolute level of rates and inflation, but you don't need that to cause a problem. All you need is even 4% inflation relative to the global level of interest rates, and that's a huge problem. So, I mean, that's the one problem with higher inflation now, is that the world's level of interest rates is not prepared for higher inflation. Not high inflation, higher inflation. Now, if the Fed funds rate today was 2, 2.5, 3, the 10-year was 3, 4%, you know, we can absorb a rise in inflation in terms of the rate picture. But when you have short rates at zero, when you have negative rates overseas, and a 10-year yield of only 160, that is not preparation for sustainable inflation.
No, I can't conceive of this notion of negative rates, negative nominal rates. We have negative real rates, I guess, right now. And how, what that's going to do, I guess if all of the country, all of the countries in the world are doing the same thing, then the game can go on for a while. But at some point in time, it's just negative rates just don't compute. I don't understand how they can work. And Europe has had negative rates for a while now. How is that working out over there?
Well, if you look at the profitability of their banking system, it's been a complete failure. If you look at the equity value of their publicly traded banks, it's been a complete failure. As rate policy in Japan has been a complete failure, where you basically eliminate the yield curve. So not only have they eliminated the yield curve, they've also killed off their bond market. The Japanese bank stock index is down 90% from where it was in 1989. The European bank stock index, last time I checked, it was down about 70% from where it was just in 07. And the problem in Europe is that the banks are the predominant transmission mechanism for monetary policy. Most of the lending goes through the European banking system for small and medium-sized businesses. Yeah, if you're a large company, you have access to the capital markets. Well, you don't need to rely on a bank to get a loan.
Right.
You just go to a bank. I'm sorry, you just go to the markets. But if you're a small and medium-sized business, you need to go to a bank. Well, if a bank has now squeezed margins on every loan, well, they're going to be more discriminating on who they give a loan to in terms of that business's prospects or a household's balance sheet. If they had more margin in a loan, they'd be able to take more risk. So it's been a complete failure from that perspective, and that should really be the only perspective, because the banks are supposedly the transmission mechanism for monetary policy.
Yeah. Well, do you think there's any possibility we'll go negative here in the U.S. nominally?
I don't. The reason why is because the U.S. money market industry is $3, $4 trillion, and you basically destroy that industry if you went negative. So I think just from a logistical standpoint, a plumbing standpoint, it's not something that we would ever do. It would be far more, well, it's destructive as it is. I call it poison in one's financial system, but it would be ever more destructive in the U.S. again because of the presence of our money market industry.
Yeah, and Alistair McLeod, who's a frequent guest on our show, talks about the problem with negative rates for the world's reserve currency as well. He thinks that might be a bigger problem for the U.S. than for other countries that don't have such dominant global currencies. And this, I guess the sense is that commodities then could become, you know, a substitute for currencies more and more. But do you see a lot of commodity inflation then, I guess? You see that as sort of a persistent increase in the inflation pressures?
Yeah, I mean, let's break it down. I think copper right now is an ever-growing important industrial metal, that is finding new growth areas, whether it's EVs or solar panels. You take an EV car, it needs five times as much copper as an internal combustion engine. And it takes years to fully develop a mine, and we've had many years of underinvestment. I mean, over the past 6 months, I haven't seen any copper SPACs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I've seen any energy SPACs. But there's been plenty of EV SPACs where these EVs need a lot of copper. You take energy. If you're the CEO of an oil company and you're hearing about your industry is getting blasted every day by the environmental crowd and all the whole shift to renewables and EVs and this and that, you're not aggressively investing in finding new wells and finding new properties. You're just going to run your business for cash, and yeah, maybe you'll make some tuck-in acquisitions, but you're not going to get aggressive in trying to find new oil, particularly on a 5 to 10 year time horizon. So a dearth of investment is going to lead to higher oil prices. I think China has proven to be a major needle mover when it comes to global agriculture prices. They have a voracious demand for corn and soybeans because they just can't make enough on their own, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. And while I have great respect for the American farmer, and particularly and also the farmers in South America, to deliver as much per yield that they can, we're even seeing record corn and soybean acreage being planted, and we're still seeing, now we're seeing $7 corn and almost $16 soybeans. So I think that crop prices are going to remain elevated for a period of time after basically a 10-year bear market. I mean, crop prices peaked in 2011, and up until this past year has done nothing but go down, and it was a tough time for the farm industry. And I think, as I mentioned, that is about to change. Now, you look at lumber prices. Lumber has gone up so much that I don't know, I find it hard to believe that it's going to stay up at these levels for so long just because it's literally gone parabolic. But you know, even if lumber pulled back 30%, it would still be well above where it was pre-COVID.
So I guess the bottom line here, Peter, with just a couple of minutes left here, in summary, how do you think investors should be looking at this world? Rising prices, rising inflation, you know, I think something like 70% of Americans are living, before COVID, were living paycheck to paycheck. Just give us with 2 minutes left, give us an idea of what you think investors that aren't living paycheck to paycheck, but have some cash, some savings, how should they be viewing the world? How should they be investing their money?
Well, I think a lot has to do with time horizon. I think time horizon is the investor's best friend. One of the secrets of Warren Buffett was not just his ability to find great business models and invest at the right price. He had a longer time horizon than everybody else. So he wasn't bothered by declines in the market because it gave him an opportunity to buy more. I think someone who has a short-term time horizon because they have a financial commitment, whether they need to put their kid through college, or they have a wedding to pay for, or some other big event, then I would have that cash out of the markets in a bank account for the next 2 years. I think those with longer term time horizons, I think from as I mentioned earlier, investing overseas will probably give you better returns investing in the U.S. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if the next 5 to 10 years in the U.S. was one big chop fest. As we sort of digest the incredible returns we've seen over the past 10 years. But at the same time, with risks of drawdowns, especially if I'm right on inflation and where rates are potentially going. I mean, that's unfortunately what we have to look forward to over the next 6 to 12 months is constant talk about the Fed tapering. And when they start to taper, is when are they going to raise interest rates? And that's just going to be a wet blanket, but, you know, comes after gains that far surpassed anybody's expectations, you know, going into a 100-year pandemic.
Right. Okay. Gold. You like gold?
I'm very bullish on gold and silver because I believe the Fed's going to way overstay their welcome, as will all central banks. I think that negative real rates will get more negative as rates will go higher the inflation will go higher than rates. And because I'm long-term bearish on the dollar, I expect weakness there to reassert itself, and that would also be positive for the precious metals.
All right. We'll have to leave it go there. Peter, thank you so much for joining us today. Really very helpful, your ideas, your remarks, and your insights. So we'll look to thank do it again, too. I hope, sometime in the near future. Well, that is it for today, folks. Next week, John Williams, the author of Shadow Stats newsletter, will be with me. We'll also, Peter, I think we're going to have Quentin Henning is with us and Michael Oliver as well. So until next week, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.